to Power Problems. I'm John Glazer. Donald Trump's rise to the presidency has had a significant impact on Republican Party politics and the conservative movement in America generally. The party is deeply split on free trade versus protectionism. You have foreign policy hawks versus neoconservatives versus Jacksonians. You have people leaving the party. You have a contingent of what are called never Trumpers. But now, and especially after the January 6th attack on the Capitol building and the ongoing second impeachment process, the cleavages among elected Republicans are as clear to the general public as they have been to insiders for a while. One of the many areas of disagreement is, of course, U.S. foreign policy. And I've kind of been wondering what the future trajectory of the party will look like in general, but particularly with regard to foreign policy. And right now, there's really no consensus in terms of a party platform that brings Republicans together on a coherent vision for U.S. foreign policy and the U.S. role in the world. So to enlighten us, I'm pleased to have Daniel Larrison on the show. Dan is a senior editor at the American Conservative Magazine, and he also co-hosts the podcast Empire Has No Clothes. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, John. It's good to be here.
So as I mentioned, the conservative movement, such as it is sort of in a process of finding itself. When I was growing up, I understood conservatives as kind of coalescing around a set of political ideas and cultural mores. It's not all that clear what beliefs or principles or political philosophies actually guide the right at this point. Particularly in the Trump years, much of that, the ideology of the Republican Party was kind of drained, and it became more important to harp on political and cultural identity. And the only thing that really unified them was kind of opposition to the Democrats and whatever cadre makes up the so-called radical left. But as someone who thinks of themselves as a conservative, how do you see these recent developments? What do you think is going on with the conservative movement today?
Sure, thanks. So I think one of the things that does still bind most conservatives together, that I don't know that I would include myself in this, but that it binds most of the movement conservatives together, is this attitude of nationalism, which Trump, of course, tapped into and exploited very strongly with his rhetoric on immigration, his rhetoric on trade, and to some extent his rhetoric on foreign policy, in that he was emphasizing American strength, American power, and supposedly making America more respected in the world. Of course, he didn't make America more respected in the world. He achieved just the opposite of that. But in the eyes of his followers, this is the great stuff. This is the red meat that they eat up. And so I think that's the one thing that does can hold all of the different factions together. In terms of policy, I think what the Trump era has shown is that a lot of Republican voters and a lot of Republican elected officials don't actually care that much about policy ideas. And that there was quite a bit of evidence of that in the Bush years, in the way that conservatives were willing to adopt new policy ideas simply because that's what the Bush administration wanted them to do. But in the Trump years, conservatives and Republicans seem to be content to abandon policy ideas altogether to some extent. You do have some of these, I guess you want to call them intellectual Trumpists, people who are trying to put a veneer of respectability or intelligibility on Trumpist instincts. But I don't think they're very representative of their own faction, much less the entire party. And so you have this move towards kind of anti-intellectualism, emotionalism, these appeals to grievance and resentment, over and above everything else. And that's how you end up with this sort of uprising in defense of such a terrible president. Because it's not as if he has done such great things for the country that he needs to be kept in office. But the personal attachment, the worship of the president himself, has kind of taken the place of any kind of well thought out agenda.
I'm glad you brought up the Bush years. One of the reasons I wanted to have you on is that the magazine you write for has a kind of special place in the history of intra-conservative ideological battles. talk a little bit about the establishment of the American Conservative magazine and what kinds of ideas were splitting conservatives back then.
Sure. Well, so TAC was founded or co-founded by, of course, Pat Buchanan, Scott McConnell, and Taki Theodorakopoulos in 2002. And they formed the magazine principally as a vehicle for expressing conservative opposition to the pending invasion of Iraq that was already being discussed and debated that year. And it was, of course, an extremely unpopular position to take at the time, especially among conservatives. For me, as a student at the time, it was very exciting to see a magazine like that come out because it lined up so closely with what I was thinking about in terms of foreign policy and the war that was about to begin. And so it was a kind of a surprising development that they would stake out this position when it was, it seemed like the politically suicidal thing to do. Of course, the magazine has been completely vindicated in the opposition to the war and Bush's foreign policy more generally. And as we come up almost 20 years now since the founding of TAC, we're starting to see some greater progress both on left and right towards a more well-crafted alternative to the current strategy of primacy. And of course, that's the strategy of restraint that the magazine has been championing now for many years. And so TAC comes out of the traditions of the old right. It comes out of the anti-imperialist and anti-interventionist traditions in American history, dating back to well before the existence of the conservative movement itself, and draws on those traditions to offer up an alternative that actually does try to put American interests first and foremost and at the center of our foreign policy thinking. And so it's been interesting to see how that rhetoric or that language has started to be co-opted by people that clearly don't believe in it. So you have the president saying that he's America first, but actually catering to the interests of other states almost exclusively. And you have Mike Pompeo talking about realism and restraint when the policy record of the Trump administration is pretty much the exact opposite of that. And of course, you guys have talked about this in the book that you published a couple of years ago, that Trump actually represents very strong continuities with previous administrations, and especially with the Bush administration, in their militarism and their adoption of primacy and their general attitude towards the world.
Do you see a connection between the Iraq War and its aftermath and what all that did to the conservative movement and why Trump became ascendant and where we are now? Or do you not see that connection?
There is a connection, certainly. The Iraq War was very damaging to the Republican Party, of course, with the country as a whole. And it also served to discredit a lot of Republican elites in the eyes of their own voters. And so the failure of the Iraq War and the sort of the interminable nature of the conflicts that foreign policy elites kept getting us into created an opening for someone like Trump to exploit, not because he was a principled anti-war person, as we know he was not. He didn't actually oppose any of the wars during that period when they began. He would simply jump on to popular discontent and exploit popular discontent with those wars afterwards. And so the failure of the war and the failure of the ideology that inspired the war gave Trump the opportunity to demagogue that failure and to use it for his own purposes.
You know, I wonder if going back a little further can help us understand better. In the 1960s, you know, elite conservatives at places like National Review and elected Republicans started to get kind of concerned about the influence of, you know, like John Birch Society groups on the right that became kind of captured by Cold War hysteria and promulgated a bunch of wild conspiracy theories about communist infiltration and so on. And the Republican Party back then, much like now, was actually fearful of condemning this group because it had such influence among Republican voters. And I mean, so maybe any nostalgia that I have about, you know, conservative unity in the past is kind of hindsight bias.
Well, certainly there have always been divisions among conservatives, sometimes quite vicious ones. One of the things that National Review became famous for over the decades was its periodic purges of those elements in the conservative movement that they deemed to be no longer welcome or no longer acceptable. And so there's always been factionalism. There's always been contention among people on the right. But I think the Cold War provided a veneer of unity or a sense of common purpose that allowed those divisions to be masked and papered over for a long time. And when you had the Soviet Union disappear and the great threat of communism recede and essentially become irrelevant in the 90s, that's when you started to see the crack-up begin the first time around. And it wasn't as obvious in the 90s because it was a time of expansion and relative peace and prosperity as far as the later decades were concerned. And so,
although I remember some Republican opposition to the Balkans interventions that sort of sounded like later Trumpy opposition.
Right. There were stirrings of that. And I think there were some legitimate objections to those interventions. There were also a lot of partisan opportunistic objections where Republicans in Congress who would normally never question presidential orders to launch an attack suddenly became very concerned about the Constitution. And then, of course, as soon as Bush became president, they dropped all of those objections immediately. The fight over the Balkans is interesting because it exposes some of those divisions that become more important later. But it was also actually the vehicle for transforming some of the Republican office holders from the late Cold War into out-and-out hawkish interventionists. I'm thinking especially of John McCain. Prior to the Balkan Wars, McCain was not especially aggressive in his advocacy for U.S. intervention in other places. And in fact, he was one of the early members in Congress to criticize Reagan's involvement in Lebanon, which almost no one remembers on either side of the debate. It's so buried by his later hawkishness. And it was actually the Balkan Wars that propelled him into that interventionist camp. And then he just kept going from there and never looked back.
You know, as I look at politics today, if I think about Congress, there's an interesting thing happening where there's a certain contingent of elected Democrats who are quite willing to emphasize the need to pull back from our interventionist approach from the world. And they have a bit of overlap with a certain contingent of Republicans that are willing to do the same thing. But of course, it's not representative of the entire party. And at the same time, there's so many disincentives to work across party lines right now. And so you have this weird halfway bipartisan approach on foreign policy that leaves hope for, you know, a trajectory that could go in our way, so to speak. But I mean, are there opportunities for Republicans and conservatives to cohere around a foreign policy? Do you expect that to happen, or do you expect further kind of disintegration on foreign policy?
I'm hopeful that there will be more cooperation between progressives and anti-war conservatives and libertarians. Of course, we see that institutionally to some extent in the creation of the Quincy Institute in the last year. And we've also seen it in practical terms in Congress in the cooperation on war powers bills, especially on Yemen, and more recently in response to the assassination of Soleimani, where there was a bill that stated that the president didn't have authority to launch an attack on Iran, which should be uncontroversial, but was surprisingly hard to get. And of course, Trump vetoed that as quickly as he could. So there are some reasons to hope that there will be a continued sort of left-right alliance, at least on war powers and on military interventions and things of that nature, in terms of larger agreement about changing U.S. foreign policy or changing our strategy worldwide. I'm a little more skeptical that there will be as much cooperation, again, because as you say, there are strong disincentives to challenging that the current strategy and questioning it. Because, of course, especially in the Republican Party, whenever you start talking about retrenchment or even minor adjustments to our strategy, that's when everyone starts screaming about isolationism and retreat and so on. And so you do see some members in the House and in the Senate on the Republican side that are willing to overlook some of those problems, to work with Democrats on war powers. And I'm hopeful, especially in the near term, that we'll see that again on Yemen, because that, of course, that's one of the most urgent issues that the new administration will be facing in this year.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Yemen is one of those issues that, as you mentioned, Republicans and Democrats did kind of come together and try to pass war powers resolution to stop our involvement. Unfortunately, it was vetoed, but that is one of the issues that we did see some cooperation on. So give us a little bit of background on that. We know recently, as the Trump administration was leaving, Secretary of State Pompeo imposed a designation of official terrorist designation on the Houthi group, which is the main belligerent in Yemen. And that presents all kinds of problems with regard to delivering humanitarian aid. And it looks like the Biden administration has at least pumped the brakes on that. But give us the background.
Sure. So the Saudi coalition started their intervention in Yemen in March 2015. The Obama administration at the time threw its support behind that coalition, providing them with refueling and arms and logistical support and intelligence support, as well as providing them diplomatic cover at the UN and elsewhere. And that then morphed into a more escalated campaign as when Trump took over and he removed any remaining restrictions that the Obama people had put in place to limit the kinds of weapons that the Saudis and the UAE were getting. The Houthis had taken over the country, or had taken over the northern part of the country, at least, in 2014. And then they had driven the Saudi-backed president out of the country the following year. And it was the flight of the Saudi-backed president that led directly to the intervention. For the last 6 years, the U.S. has been consistently backing the Saudis and the UAE as they devastate the country and also strangle it with economic warfare and blockade. And now, as a parting shot, you mentioned Pompeo's designation of the Houthis, which would effectively cut off northern Yemen from the outside world in terms of economic exchange and humanitarian aid. And many aid agencies have warned that this would lead directly to a massive famine, probably the worst in 40 years. And so the Biden administration has suspended that for a month, using a license to essentially say that aid organizations and businesses and banks can continue to do business that they've been doing. They won't run afoul of U.S. sanctions. While the Biden administration does a review of that issue, and I hope chooses to reverse the designation, which is also a baseless designation, because the Houthis don't engage in terrorism against the United States. And it's always made it very strange that we're in this war against them, when prior to the intervention, they were actually tacit partners of ours against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So it's a very bizarre policy. It's an awful policy, and I'm hopeful that the Biden administration will follow up on reversing the designation by ending all U.S. support for the war as well. And that's something that Biden has said that he's going to do. That at least that's what he said during the campaign. I think a lot of people are hoping that that turns out to be the case.
Do you think that? What is the discussion among Republicans on this issue? What's the strong Republican conservative foreign policy argument for continuing to back the Saudis in this war, which is really damaging not only on a humanitarian basis, but in terms of like U.S. interests? It's not beneficial. And I think the other side on the right tends to just see this through the lens of Iran. And so long as the Houthis have some kind of connection to Iran, their Iran hysteria will lead them to support the Saudis. But that kind of reveals the problem with our approach to that region in general. So, I mean, among conservatives, how, Is this one of those issues that maybe we can bring into a more of a consensus position that we should not support repressive monarchical authoritarians as they slaughter defenseless and impoverished populations that neighbor them? That seems like a basic argument that conservatives should be able to hop onto.
It should be, and I think you do see a lot more support for ending our involvement from the right than you might see with some other wars. Actually, that's why the Yemen War Powers Challenge was able to not just reach the floor, but to pass both houses multiple times, despite resistance from the leadership, despite resistance from the Pentagon, despite resistance from the president. And so there was a strong sense that not only was this policy wrong and harmful to our interests and to regional stability, but there was also the constitutional question that informed a lot of conservative opposition to it, which is that Congress had never authorized our involvement in this conflict. And so that that brought over some people, I think, who might otherwise buy into the anti-Iran argument, specious as it is, because they saw this as a case of presidential overreach and a case where Congress needed to claim back some of its responsibilities. And so I think, especially when you have an unauthorized military intervention like this, that's where the opportunity to win over conservatives is strongest, because the war powers argument does have some real purchase there. And I think it also helps that the war is being waged primarily by the Saudis. The Saudi government is extremely unpopular in this country, for good reason. And the relationship with the Saudis is extremely unpopular in this country. And so those things all combined to make for an unusually strong opposition to this policy. Looking forward, I'm not sure how much conservative criticism of the Saudis and UAE we're going to keep seeing. There was a brief moment there, especially following the murder of Khashoggi in 2018, where it became very advantageous for Republican politicians to position themselves as being anti-Saudi, even though they traditionally weren't. And it helped that the Saudi government was behaving especially recklessly in most of its foreign policy dealings, provoking and alienating everyone. And so I wish it weren't so, but I fear that that's probably going to be the high watermark of pushback on these kinds of relationships on the right. And we're going to see during the Biden years a reversion to the same old, we have to stand with our allies, we have to oppose the evil mullahs, and there will be no learning going on at all. And unfortunately, that's one of the things we've seen on the right for the last 20 years. You have catastrophic policy failures, many of them eagerly supported by hawks in the Republican Party, and then there's really no learning that takes place after that as to why we shouldn't do that again.
You know, one of my concerns for the post-Trump years was that there'd be a lot of incentive on the Democratic side to do anti-Trump things or things that are perceived as anti-Trump. And as you kind of implied, that part of that means sort of reinforcing our commitment to allies. And I suspect that part of it will manifest in a kind of tougher, more hardline position towards Russia because of Trump's kind of obsequious rhetoric towards Russia. There might be some hope, though, that this won't turn out to be as much a partisan issue. It's apparent that the Biden administration is interested in trying to save the New START treaty and do some kind of arms control diplomacy with Russia. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe in general what you expect out of the Biden administration's approach towards Russia and if there's chances for Republican agreement along those lines?
Sure. So the good news first is that Biden and Putin have agreed to an extension of New START. On our end, the extension of the treaty doesn't require any action by Congress. It can be done by the president himself. Of course, this is the arms reduction treaty that was ratified in 2010 and went into force in 2011. It was due to expire in just a matter of, in I think, 2 weeks from now. And so it was very urgent that Biden act on this, because this is the last real arms control treaty still standing after the Trump administration took out all the rest. And so that's a promising sign for some basic level of a constructive relationship with Moscow. But I notice that it is paired in both Biden's rhetoric and his actions with a generally more combative attitude towards Russia overall. And so he and his officials, his national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, for example, speaking out very loudly against the detention of Navalny in Russia, and also calling attention to alleged Russian interference in our politics. So there's definitely a sharper edge to Biden's dealings with Russia on a lot of issues, and I expect that to continue. Biden has traditionally been something of a Russia hawk. He has been a big proponent of NATO expansion in the past. He has supported sending lethal assistance to Ukraine, and continues to support that today. And I imagine that there are going to be a number of issues where the U.S. and Russia continue to clash quite sharply because of this approach from Biden. And I don't know that I'm that worried about more NATO expansion that might precipitate a crisis, but that's certainly a possibility.
I recently saw a statement from Mitt Romney, who's kind of at the center of this split within the Republican Party. And he suggested that, you know, there's going to be a battle for leadership over the party. And it can either go to folks like Larry Hogan and Tom Cotton on the one hand, or Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley on the other. Now, that has all kinds of implications, including for foreign policy, which is what we talk about here. But talk about that battle, how you think it's playing out, and how you think it might play out over the next 4 years.
It's funny that you mentioned Romney's comment, because I noticed that one as well, and I thought it was very funny that he put Tom Cotton in the first group among those Republicans that I suppose Romney thought of as the responsible ones, the serious statesmen, if you will, when Tom Cotton is probably one of the biggest trolls in Congress, not to mention one of the biggest hawks. So it's very strange to think of him as being in any way a kind of responsible leader. But I think the reason that Romney divided them up that way is that Cotton did end up being on the side, the more responsible side of the Republican Party in terms of his reaction to Trump's attempt to steal the election, whereas Cruz and Hawley threw in entirely with Trump, have been very proud about throwing in with Trump. Cotton has been, I think, a bit smarter about it and has held his fire and not gotten onto that side of it. And he did not challenge the certification of the election when it came up to up for a vote. And so I think Romney is looking at it in terms of domestic politics, or in terms of which Republicans are on his side of that particular divide. When we look at the foreign policy dimension of it, I don't know that there is such a sharp divide. Tom Cotton and Josh Hawley are actually pretty much simpatico. As I understand it, Hawley looks to Cotton as a mentor. And so
Ted Cruz isn't exactly dove of the month either.
Exactly. So as you look ahead for likely 2024 candidates on the Republican side, you're actually looking at a bunch of candidates that, or possible candidates that are not that different from each other in terms of their hawkish approach to things. It may only be in terms of the degree of their hawkishness, where Cotton is probably the most hard line of the bunch. Hawley may be somewhat less so, at least rhetorically. But when it actually comes down time to vote on things, he and Cotton end up being on the same side. And for that matter, so does Cruz. So while we have seen some encouraging signs of greater interest in war powers, some stirrings in favor of restraint on the right, when you look at the elected leadership, you're not seeing that at all. And in fact, you see most of the most ambitious politicians going in the opposite direction, which I think long term actually spells bad news for the Republican Party, because it's going to make them more toxic over time as they become identified more and more with that kind of reflexive militarism.
Yeah, it's interesting in a way, like for all that I said about the differences and disagreements within the Republican Party and the conservative movement, I sometimes get the sense that elected Republicans, I mean, there are differences between some of these elected Republicans, and there's certain aspects of the party that I would like to see extinguished earlier, sooner than others. But it seems sometimes that the populism that characterizes a lot of Republican rhetoric these days, when it comes to foreign policy, is pretty thin. Maybe it's calculated to when Trump is no longer a major factor, and setting the tone for how we talk about U.S. foreign policy. But they'll still be rather populist and Trumpy on other issues. So it's like the worst of both worlds, in a sense. If all these Trump-leaning populists retain their hawkishness on foreign policy, you get a kind of Republican Party that's morphing towards Trump, but maintaining its traditional interventionist approach to foreign policy. And that seems not great. That seems like a double whammy in terms of negative news in the future.
I think that's probably right. One of the things that I've noticed during the Trump years is that one of the ways that Trump manages to keep the party united behind him, or the way that he did keep them united behind him when he was president, is simply through projecting sort of aggressiveness and combativeness. And so they would reward him simply for making sort of deranged threats against other countries. It didn't matter to them that he didn't carry them out. It didn't matter to them that these threats may have increased the chances of war. What they wanted to see was the display of aggressiveness as a way of projecting American greatness in their minds. And so I think that's where you're going to see a lot of the so-called populists trying to have it both ways, where they'll talk as though they want to get into 10 different wars, but they'll actually be more careful in practice. But they'll still end up ratcheting up these fears of foreign threats, which will ultimately make it harder for us to get out of a lot of these conflicts.
Well, I didn't get the ray of hope and sunshine that I hoped I might in talking to you, but thanks so much for coming on the show, Dan.
Thanks very much, John. I appreciate it.